Homicide is as much about character as it is about crime solving. In this scene from an early episode, Tim Bayless, a rookie homicide detective played by Kyle Secor, is in the car with his more experienced and cynical partner, Frank Pemberton, played by Andre Brower.
You know something? You said to me something the other day. You said that I would never be a homicide detective because I don't have a killer's mind.
Mm-hmm.
So do you?
Do what? Do I have the killer's mind?
Yeah.
Do me a favor. Take a look outside there. Tell me what you see.
Now, let's see. I see people hanging out on their stoops. I see some trees. I see a grocery store.
Okay, I look out here and I see the same stuff, but all this stuff has my name written on it, just like the criminal. I see unlocked cars. I see snatchable pocketbooks. I see windows open just a crack.
What does this have to do with murder? That's funny.
Don't you get that?
What?
That's my point exactly, Bayless.
Before Tom Fontana co-created Homicide, he spent 5 years as a producer and writer on St. Elsewhere. We talked about Homicide in 1993, 6 weeks after the show premiered. You said that you get notes from the censors, from the networks, from the studio. What kind of notes do people give you when they're critiquing a script or an episode?
Well, the censors' notes are always very difficult to take because they, for example, on one show, we had this this sequence where one of the detectives was telling a Polish joke, and one of the other detectives was saying, well, why does it have to be Polish? And there was a discussion about between a couple of the detectives about why a Polish joke is a Polish joke as opposed to a Belgian joke, right? Now, I'm besides being Italian-American, I'm Polish-American, and I didn't find the sequence particularly offensive as a Polish-American because it was about exactly that. Why do people tell Polish jokes? It makes no difference. Well, the censors, you would have thought we had, taken Lech Walesa and, like, put paint all over him or something. I mean, the reaction was, oh, you can't make fun of Polish people. No, we're not making fun of Polish people. We're making fun of people who make Polish jokes. No, you can't do that. Anyway, you know, you fight and fight and fight, and part of it is you put stuff in, and then depending on how you're feeling that particular week, you know, you either fight for it or you say, forget it, I'll just cut it out. That week we fought for it, so it stayed in. And, the notes from the network tend to be, oh, why can't they all hug each other? And, you know, wouldn't it be nice if they actually captured somebody or somebody, you know, said, I'll never do that again. You know, they always want the easiest kind of comforting resolution because they have no... I'm amazed. I think that the network has virtually no faith in the intelligence or the sense of humor of the American public. I think they think America is just filled with completely stupid people who don't get anything, you know. And this is from, you know, guys, you know, middle-aged white guys who live in the Pacific Palisades who know no more about the general American public than George Bush did.
Well, when you're starting to write or conceive of a series, are you always second-guessing what are the network executives going to want? What will the censor say?
Well, you try not to let that influence you too much. With St. Elsewhere, the hilarious thing was they constantly wanted to turn it into Young Dr. Kildare. And we did everything we could to resist that because it's boring. It would be boring to write that every week.
What did you get the most grief for from the censors on that?
On St. Elsewhere?
Yeah.
We did a story about testicular cancer, and we weren't allowed to say, we actually got permission to say the word testicle, which was a huge breakthrough for them. We were not allowed to say the word balls, and it was about a bunch of college students, one college student in particular who had testicular cancer. And so it was kind of odd, these guys, you know, a bunch of college guys sitting around talking about testicles. But at least we got to say the word testicle. But we got, what was incredible about it is they didn't want us to do the story at all. Did not want us to do the story. When they read it, they were freaked out, the censors. They said, you cannot cut off a guy's ball on national television. It's just, you can't do it. So we said, well, that's interesting because last week we cut off a woman's breast and you didn't even raise an eyebrow about that. And that kind of made that problem go away. I mean, they suddenly went, you know, because we were going to go to the press with that. We were going to say, hey, oh, you know, it's okay to, like, do a mastectomy. but it's not to cut off a guy's ball on television. This is ridiculous. It's a double standard. And but the fight for what words you could use to say testicle was hilarious.
Now, you were going to go to the press if they didn't let you do that. That's a tough choice to make, isn't it? Because if you alienate the network too much, that's going to be a big problem for you.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, sometimes when, you know, it's one of these things where you know, they suck it in and you suck it in. And then eventually you like say, I'm pissy now. I'm in the mood for a fight. And what they do is they'll tend to back down and then they'll kind of say, well, you're going to see, we're going to get letters. Oh, it's going to be terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I guess for as often as they get letters, they don't get letters. I mean, what was the ironic part about the whole testicular cancer story was that the letters we got were from young guys who said they never knew about testicular cancer. They didn't know you could do a self-examination. They didn't know that they were particularly a risk group, and that they did the self-exam, found out that they had a lump, went to the doctor, and were alive because they had been watching St. Elsewhere. So, you know, those are the kind of letters you should just kind of go, nyah, 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 to the network with, because when you can really, you know, do something like that. I mean, we never did, well, I shouldn't say that. We often did things that we did just to piss them off. But a lot of times we were trying to be as responsible as we could possibly be. You know, we did a thing about a breast self-examination, and because one of our characters had breast cancer, and they wouldn't let us, oddly enough, they wouldn't let us show her do a self-exam, but they would let us show on a monitor the American Cancer Society's breast self-examination. So we had to do it like a session where a bunch of women were being instructed about, but you. A woman couldn't actually, I mean, we're still seeing a nipple on television, but because it was on a monitor, they thought that was okay somehow. It's that kind of thing that makes you crazy, because it all seems kind of arbitrary and ultimately it gets kind of debilitating.
What were some of the lessons you learned from St. Elsewhere about what you have to do to make that continuing storyline work?
Well, I think that one of the mistakes we made early on in St. Elsewhere was not allowing the audience to get to care about the patient, so that when we killed the patient, which we always did, we wanted the audience to have some kind of an emotional response to that. The way we did that was by tying it into the doctor or nurse who was taking care of that particular patient. On homicide, it's a little different because the focus of the story is a person who's been murdered. So you don't really have a lot of communication between the detective and the murder victim. So what we've tried to do with homicide is to deal with it much more on the relationships between the two detectives working on the case, and kind of the horror of what they experience on a day-to-day basis. I mean, these are guys who every day they go to work, their job is to look at a dead body, something that most of us do maybe once in a lifetime and are repulsed by it then.
When you're doing a series, you write a lot of the episodes.
Yeah, what I do is I tend to conceive the story for the episode and then hire a freelance writer or a story editor who's on staff. They then do like two drafts of the script. And then it comes back to me. Well, each draft comes back to me for notes, and then the draft comes back to me for final for a polish, and that's pretty much, you know, I have the final say. Then I get notes from the network and the censors and the studio and, you know, everybody's and their grandmother, but pretty much I do the final script that goes out of the set, and if the actors have any changes, they come and deal with me about them.
Now, how do you feel about this idea of conceiving of the story and giving it out to a freelancer to actually write?
Well, it's actually a lot better for me than it is for the freelancer, because I conceive it, and because I get it at the end, I can make sure that the story I wanted to tell gets told. I think it's a little frustrating to be a freelance writer in television, because you have no power whatsoever. The only reason I'm a producer is because I learned very quickly that in Hollywood, if you don't produce, you you, if you're a writer and you don't produce, you're never going to see what you've written get on the screen. I always try to keep as much as I possibly can of the freelance writer stuff, but a lot of times they either just don't get it, or they, or you know, it's just not what I had intended, and I haven't been able to convey to them properly what I was looking for.
I know you used to be a playwright. Does the playwright within you say, "This is no way to write"?
No, actually, I was a terrible playwright and a particularly unsuccessful playwright. So I've gotten more off my chest writing for television. And more people have seen it than, you know, I used to play to houses of six. And now, you know, 30 million people or 10 million people will see the show. And that's pretty pretty juicy for a writer to know that that many people are at least going to, you know, on their way to the kitchen to get something, they'll be watching what you're doing.
My guest is Tom Fontana, executive producer of Homicide. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1993 interview with Tom Fontana, executive producer of Homicide. The opening episode of Homicide was on just a few weeks ago, right after the Super Bowl, right?
Right.
Good placement.
43 million people
yeah,
saw it.
Not bad. What are some of the burdens that an opening episode of a series has to carry?
Well, you know, it's very tough to write the first episode, because what you have to do is you have to introduce... In terms of an ensemble show, it's difficult. Not all pilots are difficult, but an ensemble show where you have 10 to 12 different characters, introducing those characters, defining those characters in a very short amount of time is very difficult. Then the added burden is, you know, you want the audience to like the 10 or 12 characters that you've introduced. So that, because episodic television is about seeing friends, you know, every week you say, oh, let's go see what those knuckleheads at Cheers are doing. And so you want the audience to not necessarily identify so much as appreciate the characters on your show. So that's difficult, because you only got 47 minutes or something like that. Then what you want to do is to try to come up with a story or stories, in the particular case of Homicide, that will indicate the kind of stories that you're going to tell on a week-to-week basis. Now, in the Homicide, the first episode of Homicide, we didn't really emphasize the story. And it wasn't really till the second episode that we really, really started to say, okay, well, here's the A, B, C, D side of the show. You know, here's a... little journey that you're going to take each week with these people. One of the reasons we did that in the first episode is, again, because we wanted to say to the audience, whatever your expectation is of a cop show, you ain't going to get it here. And as dangerous as that is, because, you know, most people want to see things they're familiar with, we thought it was important to say that to the audience, to not lie to the audience and say, well, you're going to get to see them arrest somebody every week and it's going to be, you know, like a typical cop show.
So what were some of the expectations that you felt you had to dash early on?
Well, I think that, for example, the show, the emphasis on the show is not on solving the murders. The emphasis is on the relationship between the partners. And so you might spend... Whereas in a regular show, you'd spend, you know, 45 pages dealing with the murder and 10 pages dealing with the kind of buddy side of it, you know, the joking and the, oh, you know, jump in the car and all that stuff. We do the complete opposite. Most of it is about people kind of living their lives, and every once in a while they step over a dead body. The other thing is that we're not doing any car chases. We're not doing any gun shootouts, because most homicide detectives get there after the murder. You know, they're not a part of the action the way a uniform cop would be, and theirs is a much more intellectual kind of job than any other policeman. They're there doing research and investigation, and so the rhythm of their particular job is very different from anything. Most homicide shows, you see the cops and they're running and they're chasing and they're, you know, and they're facing the bad guy and all that stuff. And it, in real life, it just doesn't happen that way. And because we were coming off of David Simon's book, and because we felt we had an obligation to the Baltimore Homicide Squad to depict them in an honest way, we kind of abandoned all that television storytelling.
Tom Fontana is the executive producer of Homicide. Tonight's season finale is also the show's 100th episode. Our interview was recorded during the program's first season in 1993. Later in the show, we'll hear from Andre Brower. One of the other stars of the series, Richard Belzer, is also a comic. Here's an excerpt of Belzer's latest comedy album, Another Lone Nut.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Here we are on Broadway. All these great shows, well, they're not that great, but there's a lot of shows around here. And the thing is, what a Broadway show costs now, like $12 million to get in? It's like, it costs $100 a ticket now, right? So it's two people, that's $200. Babysitter, dinner. You know, by the time you get to the theater and you're sitting there and you're hearing the overture, you're out $1,100 and you're really pissed off. So they have to be, they have to fool you into thinking you spent your money properly. So now on Broadway, they have these big production numbers, and like, you're in the audience, the lights go down, you hear the overture, and you get excited, you figure, hey, there was a composer, there's instruments, there's musicians, somebody went to some trouble here, okay, it's a show, I'm feeling pretty good. And then the curtain opens up, and let's say the show is a musical about big business, all right? There's like, they have to impress you, so there's like 100 switchboard operators lined up, all these great Aryan youth all lined up at the switchboard, and they're taking messages. Hello, yes, no, Mr. Jones isn't in. Message for Mr. Jones, he's not in. Mr. Jones, he's not in. Mr. Jones, well, he's out, he's not in. Mr. Jones isn't in. Mr. Jones. Then a guy comes in with a briefcase. I'm Mr. Jones, any messages? Any messages? Yeah, I got a message, I want my money back. That's my message. Did you get that little pink slip while you were out? Yeah, while you were out, I want my money back, okay? Thank you. Then they have these really terrible lyrics. They're supposed to think these are great songs, so they sing them real dramatically, like, hey, Joe, do you think if I stand on the corner and make believe I'm waiting for a bus and Mary walks by, she'll fall in love with me? Does she have any messages? Any messages?
Richard Belzer from his CD, Another Lone Nut, on the Uproar Entertainment label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.